Tuesday, August 3rd. As the weekends become longer and the working middle of the week shorter, it also becomes more staccato, more piled up with work. And so Tuesday was a rush from the beauty parlor back to the desk to talk about the Life article with Liz, the captions for it, then to the Rose Garden for the ceremony for General Clifton, where about 200 of the General's friends watched Lyndon pen the Distinguished Service Medal on Ted. Lyndon, who so often thinks of the right, fresh, sweet thing to say, said, "I have done this many times, but before I've always had Ted to help me." And in his speech there was the praise for 4 years of service in the higher councils of our government, and his influence, at least upon me, has been of the greatest value, and I think the greatest worth to his country. He's made so many things easier. I can't help but feel a flicker of uncertainty that all the old team is leaving at the same time. General Clifton, Commander Josephson, Colonel Cook. And then Ted Clifton made a rather lengthy reply, in which he did just what I always want everybody to do, thank all the folks that worked together to make this complex circus run. The cameraman, the communications man, the folks that handle the baggage, and all the staff everywhere. Hugs and thanks and goodbyes all around. And then quickly to snare Jack for a few minutes advice on the titles for the Life article. I'm writing them myself. Lunch in my room, and then to the East Garden, the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden, for a ceremony about the beautification of post offices. 16 postmasters were presented with citations of merit by me for the spade work they have done in sprucing up the grounds of their post office landscapes. The awardees ranged from Mrs. Schmidt from a small rural community of 2600 Troy, Illinois, to Granville Elder of the handsome metropolitan post office of Houston. They'd been regional judges of the East Coast, the West Coast, and the vast central part of the country. They'd traveled and seen many post offices. These 16 were their cream of the crop for the changes made. It was Tyler Abel's idea, I'm sure. And the main burden of my speech, my small words, were that with 34,000 post offices across the land, each of these could certainly be an example, a catalyst for their communities. I also hope it would serve as an example to the other federal agencies. There were wonderful before and after pictures for the press to see, and good little human interest stories about our garden clubs, nurserymen, civic leaders, even the drive-in restaurant close by had joined in to help out on the various planting projects. Does it make any impression? Does it amount to anything? All these little things I do to try to encourage, spur, thank, give awards to many of the people who put their shoulder to the wheel in the beautification drive. Who knows? At least it's the only way I know to try to help. Then I went to Lucy's room, where Lucy, Linda, and I curled up on the bed to look at a big stack of pictures Linda had taken on her 6 weeks trip through the West. The Life spread lacks a picture of the three of us together. And curling up on the bed is the natural way we meet and talk and philosophize. And then, the next thing on the day was to go to the green room to meet six ambassadors' wives, convoyed by Katie Lockheim. Anne Han is out of town. They were Mrs. David Bain going to Gabon, Mrs. George Fellman going to Malta, only 32,000 people, Mrs. Parker Hart on her way to Turkey, probably the most interesting and articulate of the group, Mrs. John Jernigan to Algeria, Mrs. David Newsom to Libya, and Mrs. Hugo Smythe to the Syrian Arab Republic. We had tea and round-the-room conversation in the loveliest of all the formal rooms to me, the green room, with that outstanding early ambassador, Benjamin Franklin, gazing down on us. And then we went out on the portico. I spent my time trying to extract from each a little nugget of information about her service in the past or the country she was going to or some most interesting experience. Mrs. Hart spent a lot of time in the Arab countries, had done a history of Yemen, made a list of the local birds of Yemen, had tried to stir the interest of the women of Saudi Arabia in volunteer public service work. A hard job, I'd say. And very interestingly, she'd had a little school for young children in one of the Arab countries. In the tests, they had all proved normally intelligent until it came to arithmetic. There they had dazzling high marks. They thought they had given the intelligence test wrong. They did them over again. Once more, they were practically all geniuses in mathematics. I would have liked to have pursued it further, because after all, Aren't our own figures named Arabian numerals? Could there be a connection? But at that point, Lyndon arrived, and standing gave the ladies a sort of a coach-to-team talk that must have made them, for it did me, feel that they were manning the ramparts for America alone, that its future, its relations with the people of all the great outside world depended entirely on them, and just how intelligent and industrious and good-willed they were in their assignments to all these faraway places. I almost clapped when he finished. And what he said was, "Now, ladies, come on over to the office with me, and let's get pictures of all of us together, you with your husbands." Once in his office, he found still another ambassador there, Patricia Harris, I believe the first Negro woman ambassador, and very capable of filling the role, I'd say. Her husband had not come to tea with me and the ladies. I almost think his role is harder. We took pictures of all the family groups, the ambassador and his wife, and the two Johnsons, and then out into the rose garden for casual pictures. Then I left Lyndon for further talk with the ambassadors and their wives, because it was past 6, and the party for the celebrities in the yellow oval room must already be in progress. I'm so fond of Tony and Ann Celebrezzi, but it's with real sadness that I say goodbye to them. I think his short, plump, very Italian exterior masks more real ability than shows through to the press. And certainly he and Ann are two warm, good human beings we've loved having in our family. All the cabinet were there. The Connors, the Fowlers, the Freemans. She and I bubbling and talking about Linda Bird at the same time. And canoes and pancakes. And fishing and press. The new secretary of HEW, handsome, distinguished John Gardner alone, his wife's house hunting. The Granowskis, the attorney general alone, a summer bachelor. The McNamaras, the Rusks, the Udalls, and the humorous, delightful Wirtzes. One of the nicest things was that there were 4 young Celebrezzis, their son Tony and his new young bride, and Jean Celebrezzi and Susan Celebrezzi, and the senators from their home state, Senator Frank Lausche and Jane. I feel so fond of her. And Senator Stephen Young, small of stature but large of courage, ready to tackle any Goliath, and his wife. I got in my words for the lagging beautification bills with Senator Pat McNamara. Hardly dared mention it to Wilbur Mills. It can very well be that we've gone along doing nothing, insulated by all the mail and praise of "Isn't it a wonderful program?" while everybody against it is building up the votes that will defeat it. It was one of the nicest parties. Everybody gay and relaxed. I was particularly glad to have the 4 or 5 congressional couples to such an intimate party in the very special room. Lyndon came at 8, very late and apologetic, made a beautiful talk, and presented the silver tray. And then the spirit moved me, and I felt called upon to speak of Tony and Ann, and to quote the time in the Head Start meeting, the seminar, when he had turned the statistics and all the sociological language into a flesh-and-blood success story. And then Tony made a delightful rejoinder, one of the most memorable lines of which was, "I shall not write a book." It brought, from me at least, a laugh. You can usually tell how much people have enjoyed a party by how long they linger. And it was after 8:30 when the guests left. Lyndon asked Dean Rusk and Virginia to stay, and we went out on the porch, the Truman balcony, for another drink. He is a man of monumental patience and kindness. If he has been stabbed by some of the revelations in the hot blood history books now being written, he does not bleed in public. He used a phrase about people working in the diplomatic service in the UN that went something like this: "Go through the whole agony of understanding." A good phrase for an attempt at trying to understand our world today. He and Lyndon talked of Stevenson. He said he was a magnificent second man. No one was more glad to get a decision than Adlai, more relieved when it was made. Marvelously intelligent, capable of seeing all the ramifications and the routes, but it was an agony for him to try to decide between them, to reach the decision. So is it for everybody. It just becomes somebody's thankless job to do it. They should have sat down for dinner with us immediately, but I couldn't get them to, and it was past 9:30 when Dean and Virginia left, and Lyndon, instead of going into dinner with me, went back to the office, promising to stay only 20 minutes. It didn't turn out that way. I went to bed. It was 11:30 when he came back.